The Rufus Project would like to advise the following podcast contains spoilers for Mummy Dearest from 1981. If you do not wish to have this movie spoiled, please watch it before listening to the following podcast. We also have an additional warning, which may also count as a slight spoiler. Last chance. We would also like to advise that the following podcast contains discussions about scenes of child abuse within this movie. If you find such discussions or such concepts disturbing, we highly recommend that you check out another one of our fine redeeming featured podcasts. Is it a campy classic from the 80s or a disturbing look at the mentally disturbed? We watched Mummy Dearest from 1981 to see if it was redeemable. Were we successful? Find out after the theme!
Good to be bad, so bad it's good. What's this movie? Do you think we should? It's got bad I love, dodgy creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Hello and welcome to the Rufus Project Redeeming Features cast, this time looking at the movie Mummy Dearest from 1981. I'm your host Trevor Holland and I am joined, as always, by my good friend and co-host...
Christian Fletcher, thanks so much, Trevor, for having me back. We managed to survive the last movie and ready to tackle the next one. I'm very excited.
Absolutely. And, yeah, I've also survived this one that we're discussing.
Exactly. Mummy Dearest from 1981. For many of our listeners, and probably even for you, Trevor, it was always this sort of... it had its reputation, this film, let's just say, and a lot of people hadn't actually seen it. It's become sort of in recent years more of a cult or camp classic. So it's got quite an interesting history. And, I'm very interested to hear your thoughts on it, Trevor, because I have actually screened it a couple of times in some of my events, and I've had very mixed responses sort of from each end of the spectrum. So I'm really interested to see where you lie, and actually, to be honest, where I even lie with it as well, because I'm still very indecisive. It's one of those things that you can't help but look, you want to look away, but you can't help but watch. So I'm really interested to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, I can certainly see how this falls in the category of dividing audiences. Obviously, we'll go more into that as we go through, but I can certainly see some aspects of it that people probably wouldn't be able to handle, and other aspects which people would just be going, oh my God, look at that, with disbelief.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, I mentioned it last week when I suggested the movie, but my big thing that I was thinking about, and the big thing that we always have to consider is it actually an okay movie with a bad performance by a lead actress, or is it actually a good movie with a over-the-top performance? So yeah, it's very much, you know, like, not giving too much away just yet, we're pretty, Mummy Dearest is Faye Dunaway, essentially. So it is resting a lot on her shoulders. So a lot of what we're seeing and a lot of what we comment on is very much her performance. So yeah, it has divided fans. Some people have said she should have won an Academy Award for it. Others say she was the worst, it killed her career, and essentially did. So it is very much in two camps, and quite an appropriate word to use based on the current cult status of the film.
Absolutely. Well, I've got like a little synopsis that I've dug up, which keeps it very, very simple and brief. It's outrageous and controversial. This is the story of legendary movie star Joan Crawford as she struggles for her career and battles the inner demons of her private life.
Well, that's definitely a plot summary that manages to not say pretty much the plot.
Yeah,
as much as possible. Yeah, but then in many ways too, this film has so many levels where it can be interpreted as many different stories, you know, and that plot summary you've just read out is in many ways factual. So, it is, from a lot of people's perspectives, very dividing, divisive film. Now, Mummy Dearest was actually based on Christina Crawford, who was Joan Crawford's eldest adopted daughter. Now, she released this book in 1978. I believe it was released just after her mother's death. There was rumours that Joan Crawford knew that she was actually writing this book, but was pretty much on her deathbed. And so it was very much essentially a revenge tale that was written. And I think another big thing too, and thinking about the film too, is considering, can we believe this is being factual, or is this the work of fiction? You know, Christina Crawford has sort of become obviously a big spokesperson for child abuse, which we'll touch on with the film, and been a big spokesperson for the film itself. But she's also at the screenings of the film giving out wire hangers and encouraging people to yell at the screen. So I'm getting very much mixed messages about what this film, or what kind of her role in this is. So, you know, so you've got to also think, yeah, was Christina Crawford actually, was this actually happening to her, or did she make it up for a tell-all book? So it was one of the first tell-all books for the time, and actually was a bestseller for so many years and has been released in many editions. So it's probably quite perfect, or not perfect, but it was probably the obvious next step that they were going to make a movie out of it.
Absolutely. Well, I can tell that, I guess we're champing at the bit to discuss the movie, so I think we better get the business out of the way first, and get those get that information out there, and do the groundwork before we dive headlong into this experience. And of course we should really start out with the turkey trivia. So I did a bit of digging. It's actually rated, for a redeeming features movie, it's rated quite highly. It's 6.7 out of 10 on IMDb. And with a budget of around $5 million, it ended up taking about $25 million worldwide, but another $8.5 million in the US from home rental. So I guess obviously being made at a time when budgets weren't what they are now, it financially was quite a success.
And definitely, and you know, not revealing too much about the film, I still think for $5 million, Trevor, they've managed to achieve a great feat just in the style of the film and what, you know, the costuming and the sets and things like that. So, you know, considering some of the other movies we've watched with, you know, triple the budgets of that, and they don't even have, you know, they're barely set in a couple of rooms. So, you know, I must give them kudos for that. On a $5 million budget, they were able to do that, and hence turn a profit. But I'm sure the best-selling Christina Crawford book, Mummy Dearest, would have helped quite a lot to get those bums on seats.
Just a little bit there. Now, I kind of get the feeling that I might let you run with the trivia section of Turkey Trivia first, and then I'll see if I've got anything left over that you haven't already covered. It seems to be the safest way.
I have covered most of it, I believe, sort of at this end. But interestingly, in the early 70s, before Joan Crawford's death, she actually pinpointed that Faye Dunaway is probably one of the only actresses that she knew was an up-and-coming that had the makings of a film star. So it was interesting that she ended up getting the lead role. I'm not too sure what other – you may be able to fill in the gaps with this. I'm not too sure what other actresses were ever considered for the role, but Faye Dunaway definitely, this was post-winning Academy Awards for Bonnie and Clyde and Network in the late 70s. So, you know, she was riding on those. She was, you know, she was a very profitable film star of the 70s. So Mummy Dearest came at that time when she would have just, you know, yeah, grabbed it with both hands and was, by, you know, in most cases, trying to win another Academy Award. So, so it was, you know, being the first tell-all celebrity book, you know, God, Betty Davis's daughter, well, so many other people have done it since, you know, but Christina Crawford was the first person to do that. So I think being able to take sort of a Hollywood icon and kind of show her warts and all, it's kind of was maybe one of the first sort of backstage, you know, you're sort of seeing behind the scenes, but it was also very much a darning tale, I don't know if that's the word, a damning tale towards Joan Crawford. She wasn't exactly able to defend herself, let's just say. So that's why it all gets quite muddy with the fact that, you know, did Christina make a lot of this up, or, you know, most of it was seen through the eyes of a child. So it is quite interesting. But people close to Joan Crawford, or when I say close, that knew her, you know, actually did report a lot of the incidents in the book. They actually did see, saw those signs of abuse, and they were truthful. Then a lot of other people close to Joan had said, you know, Christina was just a spoiled brat that was very jealous and just wanted to shoot down her mum's name. So yeah, you're getting very mixed messages, and I think that's also where the film lies. You don't really know, where you should be focusing your attention.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned with the other actress, I did see that Anne Bancroft was the lead actually had the role for quite some time. And all I could find was that she dropped out quite close to commencement of filming due to creative differences. But apparently there were a lot of actresses who did turn it down because they didn't feel comfortable portraying Joan Crawford in that light.
And I think it was very bold of Faye Dunaway to do that because, you know, having had her recent death and, you know, Joan Crawford was such an iconic film star, so it was probably also felt like they were sort of tiptoeing on her grave by doing that. But, yeah, Faye Dunaway just didn't seem to mind too much. But the lady, actress that plays the maid, Carol Ann, I can't remember, I can't pronounce her name anyway, but she's come out in interviews recently and saying that, you know, Faye Dunaway was an absolute dragon on set, wouldn't have anything to do with anybody and was a real, real diva. And, you know, sorry, I hate to go off rumours here, but you know, there's talk that Faye Dunaway is one of those actresses you never want to work with. She always seems to top those lists. So I think she would have fought her way to the top to get that role. But, yeah, a lot of other people probably could see it was a stinker early on.
Yeah, well, it was probably the first film to nearly sweep all the major, I'll put it in air quotes, awards at the Golden Raspberry Awards. It had 5 wins, including Worst Picture and 3 out of the 4 acting awards, from a record for the time, 9 Razzie nominations.
Ooh, yeah, and I can see where a lot of them are justly deserved, too. And I suppose the Razzies would have been in the very early stages, so that would have been quite a landmark achievement for them in film at that time.
Yeah, and I'm surprised you haven't mentioned this part of it, that the fact that it only took like a month from the film being released and getting a plethora of bad reviews at the time, but audience started flocking to see the film armed with Ajax and wire hangers so they could participate with the film. Quite similar to another movie that we quite enjoy participating with. And then Paramount basically jumped on that and began to build the film as the camp classic as most see it now, complete with ads and posters proclaiming me the biggest mother of them all.
Oh, and they got into so much trouble for that. They got in trouble with that from ethnic groups for being a racial slur, and then people were saying that they were damning the movie that was, you know, all these people that had worked on it were saying that now you're turning it into a bad thing. But hey, they did it. MGM did it with Showgirls, so yeah, it sort of gave it a new life. And now you can even buy the DVD of Mummy Dearest. It's like a special edition. I think it even comes with a wire hanger. You know what I mean? It's so interesting how time can, yeah, when things can happen when a studio needs to make some money. So yeah, good for bringing that up, Trevor. I had forgotten to mention that.
So before we delve full on into our chat. Of course, we do need to set the baseline, and I've been scouring the not-so-shining reviews, and they do come in quite a very mixed bag, let's just say, and in the review section of Amazon, let's just say there's a lot of essays, so I had to kind of try to find something that pretty much distilled it down to something which is, I suppose, a bit more podcast-friendly. So, well, I've got one here. It's titled 2 Hours of Hell. The Untamed Shrew with Visceral Child Abuse. 2 Hours of Hell. Horrible. 1 star.
And that's it.
That's it. They really seem to be a good summary of a lot of the essays I had to go through.
Yeah, and I think that's pretty... Hey, straight to the point, that's what you like to know for review, and it can only go up or maybe down from here. I don't know.
Yeah, and to start with that, yeah, I saw the running time and just went, gee, thanks, Christian. 2 hours. That's great.
I know, I always pick the doozies, don't I? And you've been so generous giving me hour 20 or less movies. So, I did feel quite bad. But in my defence, I've actually seen the movie probably over 5 times in my life. So it's actually one of those movies. It's probably a guilty pleasure. Okay, it is a guilty pleasure. However, having watched it for the podcast, I saw it in a totally different light. And I have been seeing it in a different light recently. Like, there are a lot of people, like, yes, I said at the screenings, you know, overseas where they all get into it. But I've also done a screening out here in Australia where people came up to me pretty much saying I'm condoning child abuse. or promoting child abuse by screening this film. So and it got a really quite an angry reaction. So it just goes to show also how American and Australian audiences respond to different things. And I think the book was quite popular out here. But yeah, so I don't know where I was getting at with that.
There are some aspects of this movie, I guess, that I'm probably going to have issues with describing. I'll come into that a bit longer. I suppose if we just work our way through it, I mean, the starting scene itself was freaking me out with, Joan Crawford scrubbing herself with the super duper steaming hot water. It wasn't so much that scene, it was the soft music that was playing behind it. And I was just going, the scene's already disturbing enough as it is, and I could handle that, but the soft music just took it to a whole new creepy level.
It was like it was trying to play for the whole sort of, I don't know, daytime soap music mixed with, the launching of a villain. It was almost like a villain raising out of, like, you knew straight away that, you know, something was quite a little bit off with this. And just those beauty routines that she was going through, like the ice on the face and, having her face, like, pretty much pulled back as she slept in masks, you know. And it just, I think that was really important, though, in just establishing straight away just how obsessive I think Joan Crawford was. Now, when I am talking about Joan, please know that, yeah, I'm referring to the movie version, obviously, listeners. Absolutely. I don't know. Obviously, you know, I'm not knowing if half the time she did a lot of these things. But let's just say, that, yeah, movie Joan we were seeing from the start that she was very, compulsive and that real sort of OCD, which comes out a lot more later. And she was very much obsessed with wanting to maintain her look. The only problem is with this film is, half the time you don't even know what year or what decade we're in, which made it really confusing. So you sort of weren't seeing, you weren't sort of knowing whether she was at the height of her fame at the start, et cetera. But, it was interesting to see her sort of getting ready and things. But, yeah, definitely established her as quite a diva / quite obsessive. So in turning herself into a movie star, maybe she was going from monster to movie star. Maybe that was the whole point of that scene.
Yeah. I mean, as it comes out further in the movie, the real, I suppose, the start of the movie is towards the tail end of her time at MGM, and obviously, as the synopsis said before, there is a lot of focus on Joan Crawford and her career and the challenges she was facing as trying to keep that movie career going. While at the same time raising these adopted children who she fought really hard to get her hands on and really fought against the prevailing feel at the time that that a woman, a divorcee no less, was in no position to adopt a child, no matter how wealthy or how good a home she could give them. I actually don't doubt that in fact was factual.
Definitely. And I think she very much, and as you saw in the movie, she was able to pull so many strings to pretty much arrange it to happen. It's funny how it happens in the movie. And one, you got the scene of at the adoption place where they're telling her, no, you're unfit for a mother. 2 seconds later, she's got Christina being delivered to her as a baby in her arms. And obviously we find out that Frank, I think it is the partner she has at the time, a lawyer, has actually arranged it for her. But it happens very quickly. And I think it's very much a lot like the movie. It's very episodic. Like it doesn't flow. It's just like one incident after another kind of thing, and it's all just sort of pieced together like that. But yeah, that does happen very quickly. But yeah, you can understand why it was you could definitely see from the start too that it was perhaps a publicity stunt, and because we do see further things down the track where she does whatever she can to remain at the top of her game. So I do wonder, she was getting older, she was wanting to have a child, but she was also seeing her career possibly slipping. So, it all timed quite well.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, you see that baby, and I think the biggest contrast is after she does get denied at the adoption agency, I think that's the first time we see Faye Dunaway hitting the level that she spends most of the movie at, just as this shouting, screaming, throwing things, absolute freak of a woman with big lips, drawn on eyebrows and just not able to take it if she doesn't get her own way.
It was, yeah, it's almost like she's playing a caricature of Joan Crawford, and it's like she doesn't build up, the character doesn't build up, we're seeing it from the start. It reminded me a lot of, actually, of The Shining in terms of, you know, Jack Nicholson, you know, even though he's supposed to go insane over the course of the movie, he was always so insane looking from the start anyway, and I kind of got the same feeling from her, you know, like, but then, hey, that was probably perfectly summing up that was what she was like all the time, but, or, you know, there was rumours that, yeah, that she was actually bipolar in real life, so, you know, so we were seeing these temper things, but yeah, Faye Dunaway was definitely, you know, was she taking it to the extreme, but when she gets those big eyes and that almost those big lips and it, you know, I'll mention later with the wire hanger scene, that kind of kabuki, scary, oh, yeah, it's quite a scary face, actually, when it's portrayed in that sort of over-the-top acting.
Yeah, and another thing I noticed quite early on in all the portrayal, like every time there was a close-up, the movie went for that, you know, classic golden age of Hollywood movie style of like having a light across the eyes.
Yeah, I noticed that a lot of scenes, and usually when she was quite mad at Christina too, it was almost like it was, instead of it being this soft focus or being romantic, it was just almost like this thin line saying, I'm really mad at you, just look at my eyes.
It was only ever done to her. No other person in the movie got that same treatment. It was like, okay, they're trying to show that she is this movie actress from the great golden age of Hollywood, and like so much of her is presented and the way she's filmed and the style that just she is filmed reflects, you know, what the movies were doing in like the 60s and 70s period with their stars.
And I think that was a big, I think, is the director Frank Perry? I don't have it handy, actually, but I think it's Frank Perry that directed it. No, I think he very much, or I suppose the cinematographer or, you know, set designers, all that sort of thing. It's like they were trying to essentially make a 40s or 50s film, you know, by really, yeah, taking it back to that golden age of Hollywood. And I do appreciate that part of the film, you know, obviously the child abuse aside, they do manage to capture that feel quite well. But yeah, I found that a lot of those focuses were really, I mean, those, like, you know, the bars over her eyes, it was almost like they were setting her out to be an absolute villain the entire way through. But I suppose maybe that's the angle we're supposed to look at it as. But yeah, it also, it made her look quite harsh.
But I mean, I think that's probably one of the first things where I started to struggle a bit was the disconnect, because everything else was filmed, I suppose, much more in that the style of the time of the late 70s, early 80s, and you know, was a much more I suppose, well, a lot less glamorous with regards to it. And when you're looking at the scenes focusing on Joan Crawford and her career versus nearly everything else, it really does get quite a disconnect going. And before you even get to any of the other things that you may find a bit unpleasant about this movie, just the feel of it and that unbalanced feel of it is present really from quite early on.
But I actually, like, I've got this, I've made reference to this in my notes, I actually thought it was, I find, even though it is very disconnect, but I found it was very kind of clever in a way, because it was almost like they were really trying to show that whole, they were trying to balance public Joan with private Joan. It was almost like they'd go from, you know, you go from one scene with her with an axe doing, you know, terrible things to the next scene of her, you know, around the microphone all having a happy Christmas. Like, I think that whole jarring segue really actually kind of was a way of almost going, you know, pretty much showing the whole fake real life. I don't know. I think that was kind of the feel they were trying to go for. Like, it would always follow. You notice it was always, if there was one of those campy over the top scenes, which most of the ones that weren't the Hollywood ones usually were, it was always followed by something almost showing her, oh, yes, I'm a lovely mother. So I don't know if it was very intentional, but yeah, I do know what you mean. It made it very disconnect and hence made it feel very episodic, where it's just one scene after another. But director John Waters actually, has often said about the film that it's actually quite a serious biopic that unfortunately has some really campy scenes that just break you out of that feel. So, yeah, I think that's kind of what we're... It could have been a good film about sort of classic Hollywood, aside from a few over-the-top moments, and there are a few.
just a few. But it gets it's relentless. And obviously a lot of this is going to be focused on Faye Dunaway's performance.
Oh, and because, like, you know, you...
It goes so big so early and doesn't let up. There is something to say about the quiet, loud style of approach. But this is just like quiet, loud, quiet.
Yeah, and if you think about it, that's actually just reminded me. If you think about it, all the supporting characters are pretty much they're not famous people. They're not, you know, barely. They don't really make much of a dent. And I don't know if that's because Joan Crawford. I mean, Faye Dunaway pretty much stole the scenery from everybody. But it's almost like they all seem to be playing it all straight, and she's just so over the top, you know. So it was really, it's like they made the supporting characters just quite meh, and Faye Dunaway's gone, I've got to bring it up another 99%, and she refuses to speak of the movie in interviews anymore. She hangs up on people and stops interviews if they mention it. But the one thing she has said is she blamed the director for as a director, not reining her performance in more as a director and telling an actress that she's, you know, doing too much. But I get the feeling that Faye Dunaway wouldn't have wanted to take that direction from him anyway. She wanted this to just be all her, I think. So, yeah, I find that quite interesting that she's passing the blame on the director for not reeling her in. So, I don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, to mention the actor that played Fred when they have their great breakup scene, he does go for it too. He actually tries to match her in that scene. But then we never see him again. So the one person who comes even close to Faye Dunaway just kind of does it briefly and is gone. And then we've just got back to quiet. Faye Dunaway! Quiet.
Yeah, and boring characters. And you don't know also, like, it's, and I don't know, like, in terms of the actors themselves, like, you know, I know I won a lot of Raspberry Awards, but there's just something about the girl that played the little Christina that just seemed like, you know, one of that, that's that real, she looked like she was acting just too much. She's just annoyed me so much, and I don't know if that was also trying to show that Christina was a bit of a, or the kid was a bit of an upstart, but then I don't think Christina Crawford would have written herself that way. So I don't know if it was just the actress, but there's just something about her. Actually, both the actresses that played Christina annoy me. But anyway.
Yeah, well, we can get into those. I mean, really, the performances in this movie, I can't really say there were any particularly strong performances around there. I mean, nobody really stands out as being a particularly good actor in this movie. It's all very, like, workable performances. I can't say anyone's particularly bad. But, yeah, it's all very workable performances across the board. But then, you know, you got Faye Dunaway.
Yeah, just, I've read a... just pretty much
being her in her own world and almost, I think, in her own movie, in her mind.
Oh, it's like she literally, you know, embodied, you know, Joan Crawford. Some people said the resemblance and the characterization was uncanny, so I don't know what's... I don't know. It's a matter of different people's opinions with it. But, yeah, but one thing I've mentioned earlier is you see very early on this sort of OCD sort of stuff. She's very obsessive, compulsive with a lot of stuff. And even early on, you've got the scene where the maid's cleaning the house, and she goes over and lifts the pot plant and finds the ring of dirt. And this is when one of the first sort of corker lines of dialogue comes in. She goes, "I'm not mad at you, I'm mad at the dirt." And as soon as a line like that comes in, you're like, "Oh, okay." And then, yeah, you then see the dialogue have many other corkers like that. But, yeah, so very early on, like, this is literally the second scene in or third scene in, and you're already seeing, okay, yeah, there's something a little bit up with Movie Joan.
that gave me a little bit of brief hope for this movie, I've got to admit. I went, "Oh, okay, that's actually kind of... That's entertaining. That's funny. I'll pay that line."
Yeah, you can see the campiness.
yeah. As it went on, well, let's just say my tolerance for it gradually decreased, but we can go into more of that later.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Well, I do find it, you know, I do admit it is a guilty pleasure, but I mean, very much say that the second half just sort of drags a lot. It is very too long in that respect, but some of the earlier scenes, you can't help but look away, and it all does come down to, with a lot of this in Christina's mind, you know, because she was a five-year-old during most of this, so it's interesting how we should perceive it, but, you know, just creepy things like how Christina's, I don't know if it was her fifth birthday, and Joan and her are wearing these matching baby doll dresses. It just kind of, and Joan, it was already so creepy, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're going around on the go around, and of course any opportunity, because of course they have to, any opportunity they have, she turns around and she goes, "Are you having a great birthday?" And she goes, I love you, mummy dearest," and the first of many times where they have to reference the name of the book and the film. But there's this really interesting shot, and I don't know if they just brought this in, you know, because they're making a movie, but where Christine is having all her photos with the presents for all the press, and there's this really vicious shot of Joan Crawford, or sorry, Faye Dunaway, just looking at the camera back down at her at the playground with this evil look on her face, like, she's stealing my limelight. So you're kind of, the whole jealousy of Christina, which is play a lot through it, is, I wouldn't be surprised if that was, very much Christina's point of view, that, that her mum was very jealous of her. But, any opportunity that could bring that kind of element into it was always there.
Yeah, and I suppose from that scene, and it was after that, I suppose we should address this elephant in the room. It's not long after that is when those abuse scenes started.
And they look, you know, this is the thing, Trevor, when it's quite... when you've got a film that is campy in some respects, and then, you're screening, you know, like, as I said, audiences are different out here where I've done it, but you can't really all go, ah, ha, ha. You do sit back, and I, you know, obviously watched it more thoroughly this time for the podcast, but you do sit back and go, wow, this is not cool. You know, this is not something in a cult movie or something that people are yahooing in a midnight movie. It's just something about it. You know, you're taking, there's a lot of scenes, and I'm sure as a parent, Trevor, seeing things like that are probably also, it would be hard for a lot of people to watch, and a lot of the ways that it's portrayed. But the fact that you've got Faye next to these characters or doing this dialogue in such a campy way, it sort of doesn't know what it wants to be. It's like she's taking the piss out of actually something that is really quite serious.
Yeah, because it kind of bookended with you know, those ridiculous campy situations, like, you know, she's being overly competitive against her 5-year-old daughter in a pool, and then her daughter gets upset, abuse, and then it's bookended later, and she's being her over the top self and campy self, which I know is what the people who enjoy this movie do laugh at, just these ridiculous things, and so the infamous coat hanger scrub scene, you know, she's having an absolute bender over the fact that her dresses are hung up with wire coat hangers, and you're just going, holy crap, this is ridiculous.
I know, and when you start
beating the child with a coat hanger, which I've got to admit is a point where I almost turned this movie off and walked away.
I know.
And then it cuts to the scene, the scrub scene, which I know is one of the fan favorites, when she's just throwing talcum powder, throwing this powder all over this bathroom, just go, we've got to scrub this floor together.
But then if you look really closely too, at one stage, she actually whacks Christina's back with the Ajax thing as well, which is also too, like, it doesn't hold back in that respect, and that's why, you know, you're seeing these people waving wire coat hangers at a screen whilst this is happening. It's just very jarring and very it's not cool.
I want to get through this because it's making me feel icky talking about it. But you got the scenes where the fact that this kid mixes drinks for her mum and her uncles who come to sleep with her mum, and she'll walk in on mum and uncle making out to deliver drinks.
Because she walks in on that, she gets sent to boarding school. she's seeing her daughter turning into her almost, and she's feeling threatened by this 7-year-old daughter. But yeah, it's you're seeing also too these signs of not a very good good mother mm-hmm. in terms of having her 7-year-old pouring drinks for her.
Yeah, when she went to boarding school, I felt a huge sigh. I feel like I felt relieved that even though this kid was in tears, not wanting to go to boarding school and be sent away from home, it's just like, yeah, you bloody go, kid, you get the hell out of there.
Surprised she wasn't doing cartwheels on the front lawn, you know. Mm. But and I think the lady at the boarding school goes, "It's all right, I understand." Like little, there's a lot of little things like that. A lot of characters, like you know, sort of supporting characters, say, and you wonder if that's them going, "Yeah, we know what your mum's like. She's crazy."
Mm-hmm. I suppose after the boarding scene, the nasty scenes, I guess because you know, at the end of it, Christina is quite grown up. Quite suddenly, after spending a number of years at this boarding school, and even though it's still unpleasant, like, say, when Joan Crawford tries to strangle her for messing up her interview with the famous author.
Even though Joan actually is the one that ends up causing the problem, making them look bad,
For which Christina gets sent to a convent.
It's like every time she does one thing, she gets sent to the next thing, you know, And even God, she gets an ovarian cyst, and like God, she has to be in hospital. And even her mum replaces her on her TV show for 3 episodes, and she's 60 playing a 28-year-old. Like she can't win.
Yeah, I know. I'm surprised that she waited until after the death to release a tell-all book. If any of this is remotely true.
Definitely, you know, and it always, I know whenever I watched it, I always wondered what she meant by at the very end of the movie where they go, she's had the last word, and then Christina goes, but has she? And yeah, for a while I used to wonder what that meant, and obviously they're referencing the fact that she was planning to write the book, but a lot of people say that, you know, there were rumours that Christina was jealous because Joan had cut her out of the will, so she decided to release this tell-all book, but apparently another lawyer had said, since the 60s, that she'd never even been written into the will. It was almost like Joan was just reinforcing the whole time to Christina, you got to make it on your own, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you'd have her spending all this lavish money on shopping and all that and coming home drunk, and then whilst Christina, you know, they won't even give her $50 to pay her rent. So, you know, I think she was very much a troubled celebrity too. And you know, with that sort of, if she was dealing with sort of bipolar and OCD and alcoholism, but it's obviously still no excuse for her childbearing techniques. Let's just say that.
And I think even though he barely gets mentioned, was it Christopher? Chris, the son?
He just rocks up one day.
he just kind of rocks up. And do you have any idea why he was strapped into bed?
Okay, I did a bit of research before, and apparently he used to do a lot of sleepwalking. So I don't know if that's in Joan's defense as a way of protecting him, but in the terms of the movie, when you're not knowing this, you know, it does come across quite strange, doesn't it? Yeah. So apparently he sleepwalked a lot, and that was the technique to deal with it. But as a casual moviegoer, you're not to know that's what it is. Just another more insane thing to happen.
Yeah, I get the feeling because, I mean, this movie is all over the place and does jump, as you said, quite episodically and quite quickly from place to place. I kind of get the feeling that there were a number of other scenes shot which probably would have explained that and quite a few other things that just didn't make the final cut.
It might have been 3 hours long, Trevor, so aren't we lucky we didn't see that version? But the interesting thing about it, how I was saying before about you've got sort of the public Joan and then the really jarring private Joan, you know, like it was always after something really positive happened that she'd have all these really evil scenes. Like I can't stand, like there's a lot of awful scenes, you know, but the scene where, you know, all Christina is doing is playing in her mum's, you know, dressing up in her mum's makeup and her costumes and stuff, like, you know, like I suppose any girl of that age would do. And she's just found out she's won the lead role in Mildred Pierce, which would end up getting her the Academy Award. So she's just had some great news. And then she comes in and sees her doing this and proceeds to yell at her and cut all her hair off. Mm-hmm. And it's just things like that you're always, and then, you know, then the wire hanger scene pretty much happened after she wins the Academy Award. It was like something really good happens. And then they had to show the total opposite to her. it was always, you know, it just, yeah, as a result, was episodic because it wasn't, the character wasn't flowing. You know, it was like, you've just come from this happy moment. Why are you coming in and being like this towards her? You know, you should be like, oh, she's dressing up. I just got this part. But instead, evil Faye Dunaway face comes in and just takes it to the next level. So I really don't think they knew what the tone was, for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioned that that second half of the movie really does drag on because it focuses so much on what Joan Crawford is doing and just occasional asides to what Christina is doing. So, I mean, I don't even know exactly who this movie is meant to be about, whether it's meant to be about Joan Crawford or about Christina. It can't seem to make up its mind, but it does spend most of its time focusing on Joan Crawford.
And there's a lot of confusing parts, like, you know, like a lot of one-on-one scenes between Joan and, say, her suitor at the time. And I was thinking as I was watching it, I'm like, well, you know, were these scenes in the book when Christina wouldn't have known half this stuff was happening? So you do wonder how much it was either embellished for the book or for the movie itself. So, yeah, so I think they wanted to make it, before doing the podcast, I did watch the theatrical trailer just to see how they kind of showed it. And yeah, the trailer pretty much shows it. It's all about Joan Crawford, the woman behind, you know, the woman behind the famous Hollywood star. So yeah, so essentially it was almost like, even though it was, you know, yeah, it was essentially the Joan Crawford story and Christina only is barely in it. But, you know, to be honest, in the second half, that's half the reason why it drags is the stuff with Christina in it, all that stuff with her getting involved with that boy at the boarding school and all that sort of stuff. And it's like, God, if you can introduce Christopher, the other kid, in like, you know, the blink of an eye, why can't you sort of tell a lot of this in a much quicker way?
Yeah, that's what I said. That was the thing. It's like, hang on. This movie about Joan Crawford or this movie about Christina, make up your mind. But then, yeah, like it keeps dragging on and on, and then suddenly Joan Crawford is sick and dead. It just happens very, very quickly and abruptly, and that's where we get to the will reading scene where Chris, who is still alive, who we haven't seen since he was told to strap himself back into bed just before that scrubbing scene.
Oh, and of course, yes, and of course, Christina introduces him to her husband, David, who we had no idea she got married.
Absolutely. And ends with the, does she, which is such an awkward way of ending the movie. I know what that meant. I mean, I got that straight away. I was like, okay, I'm going to release a book about all the horrible things that my mother did to me while I was growing up and even after I grew up. And make sure that she doesn't get the last word, and make sure that she doesn't sweep this under the rug any longer.
But then it all comes down. But then I don't know if it was the way that the character was played, but in many ways too, the older Christina was a real kind of stuck up bitch in a lot of respects. I don't know. Like it was very much. I don't know if that. Hey, God, I suppose if she'd been treated the way she had as a kid, she would be that way. But there was a lot of times where she was being very much a spoiled brat, not as the kid version, but more as the teenager. But yeah, as I said, that's hard to know whether that's, you know, why would she be nice to someone who was so terrible to her as a child? But they really didn't paint Christina in a good light. So, and a lot of people have actually said that Christina Crawford is quite a, I don't like, well, this is rumour, but, you know, isn't it a very nice person, you know? So you do wonder if a lot of this story was a jealousy thing. Maybe she was jealous of her mum, you know, and all this sort of stuff. Hey, she became an actress too. You know, she was just maybe trying to emulate her as much as possible. So, yeah, it just leaves so many questions, and I don't think we'll ever know.
No, it's very unlikely that she's going to come out and say, well, actually it happened this way. Obviously, a lot of what happened in that movie, I'm guessing, would have been exaggerated, shall we say.
Yeah, especially I think in the cinematic version as well, you know, like, to be honest, I'd like to read the book actually just to see a lot and see how much, you know, it might have just said, oh look, she came home and got mad at me about wire hangers and gave me a smack and went to bed, you know, but in movie terms it becomes this big kabuki style performance by Faye Dunaway. So yeah, you don't know whether they've just taken, or maybe they're just big sections from the movie, from the book, that they've gone, oh, let's make this a really, really big, really big part. But that actually brings me to the next bit, Trevor, and a part that I've always found another quite, this isn't involving child abuse, but just one of these bizarre scenes. Tina, bring me the axe. mm-hmm. when she gets released from MGM yeah. and her contract's over, because, you know, as you mentioned earlier, she was considered like sort of box office poison at this stage, and you know, her career was on the slide, and they pretty much decided, you know, let's part ways and you know, let's release you from your contract, because you know, that's a big, contracts are such a big thing, you know, in Hollywood, and I'm glad they do sort of go into that kind of, you know, you do appreciate sort of seeing that side of it too, and you know, how they sort of treated their royalty. But but yeah, so he releases her from there, and she goes, oh, you know, can you at least walk me to my car? And he just looks back at her like, no way. and then 2 seconds later, you've pretty much just got Joan Crawford pretty much demolishing her rose garden with a pair of secateurs, and Carol Ann, the maid, unstrapping Christopher and waking Christina up, going, quick, your mother needs you in the garden. And to be honest, if I was the maid and I knew the mother was in the garden with an axe and one of the children, I don't think I'd necessarily send them outside.
Yeah, man.
But what I don't get, Trevor, is, and I've got this question here, was it, what is it supposed to symbolise? Like, was it in terms of why in particular did she decide to start chopping down the rose garden? Why didn't she go in and start smashing vases? You know, and I don't know if this was just something that was done for the movie, but it just sort of, was she trying to cut down, was it supposed to symbolise, you know, the cutting down of a living thing, because, you know, she now feels dead inside? I don't know, I don't want to look into it too much, but the whole fact that she's just suddenly in the rose garden demolishing everything, and then gets the kids to get the wheelbarrows, like 2 a.m. in the morning, to start cleaning up the mess, and then there's that iconic shot where she just turns to the camera, scratches all over her face and goes, Tina, bring me the axe, and then chops down his rose tree, which is quite an underwhelming chop.
Yeah.
But the whole time, Trevor, I'm going, is this supposed to mean anything in particular, the whole rose garden thing, or is it just one of those insane things that this alcoholic, you know, obviously drunk woman was doing at the time? It always confuses me.
Yeah, an alcoholic temper tantrum is essentially what I got from that. But yeah, it serves, aside from making a person that has already been made look quite crazy well before that scene, it's like I said, you know, that performance of Faye Dunaway's as Joan Crawford hits its peak really early in the movie and doesn't let up.
It's got nowhere else to really go, because she doesn't sort of let back, even though I notice she tries to sort of in the later scenes when, you know, she's probably, you know, because she's portraying her quite old and Faye almost dying. Actually, that's the thing, when she's lying on her deathbed watching that Christina accept that award for her, that's probably the most subdued I ever saw Faye Dunaway in the entire movie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, she does get quite subdued, just to do a bit of a jump around, after she marries the boss of Pepsi, makes him spend most of his money, has the boss of Pepsi die, and then is approached by the board of Pepsi about how she's going to pay back the money, and it's like she's quite subdued until it gets to, you know, one of those other iconic lines in the movie where she tells him, don't with me.
This is my first time at the rodeo. Oh, and it's just little things like her going, I helped build Pepsi to what it is today, you know, and all this sort of thing. And it was always, and it's a big thing throughout the whole film, was her using her star power. And that was really quite relevant in that scene where she was pretty much going, you know, you don't want any bad publicity from Joan Crawford, you know, about your company. And then they agree to keep her on board. But, and that's pretty much the theme throughout the entire movie. And it, you know, going back to what I said earlier about the whole publicity stunt with her adopting Christina, it was just the first of many sort of things she was doing to try and revitalize this career that was, you know, sort of on the downside. But as I mentioned earlier, it was so hard to sort of know what decade or what time frame. Like, I know Mildred Pierce, when she won the Academy Award, was 1940. But from then on, things got quite muddy, and I pretty much had to judge it based on the kind of 60s-style hairdos that Faye Dunaway had. But that was always, made it quite difficult to know sort of what was going on. But, yeah, you'd assume it was, you know, at a bad time. Hey, by the mid-60s, she was doing psycho biddy roles, which are, you know, films usually involving old Hollywood actresses that are pretty much, you know, can't get work in anything else. So, and Mummy Dearest has actually been lumped in as a film of this genre anyway. So, yeah, so by the 60s, you know, things were going quite badly for her. So, yeah, she pretty much would do anything she could to grab publicity. And she does even admit at one stage that she did adopt Christina for a little bit of publicity, but then she goes, oh, no, I didn't mean that. But then I love, actually, I really, really love this line where she goes, What's the lead? What's the one before it? But and she says, why don't you give me the respect that I deserve? And Christina goes, because I'm not one of your fans.
Mm-hmm.
And that really sums it up in a nutshell, that all Joan really cared about was just that public image. So behind the scenes, she could be this absolute drag and pretty much, you know, not sort of... I think she wanted to love Christina, and, you know, even the mate, Carol Ann says later on, your mum always did love you, and then Christina goes, well, I find that hard to believe. But, yeah, you do wonder if Joan did actually love her and just didn't know how to show it because she was so fierce. I don't know, but... yeah, it's but then of course it goes from, you know, I'm not one of your fans, to her pretty much strangling her, but it doesn't, not just strangling her or attempting to strangle her, but knocking over a glass table, lying on top of her, knickers flashing in the air and everything, and literally, it's like a drag queen or something was playing Faye Dunaway in that scene, and then you see her do this triple roll. It was just the most over the top bit ever. As you've got Carol Ann and the reporters, you know, pulling her off her, and she does this kind of King Kong like thing in the air, like and you're just like, oh my god! And this is 20 minutes from the end of the movie. You're like, God, she's maintained this the entire bloody way. It's like, but I think because, like, as we were saying, Act Two is quite, it kind of drags a lot, and it's like a lot of that sort of really, you know, psychotic stuff happens, you know, very much in the earlier scene. So it's almost like they chucked that in as a, oh, God, we need some more action around this bit, you know, some more crazy Joan, and, yeah, they definitely achieved it.
Yeah.
But an interesting thing, like when I have screened it before, like, you know, I always get up and ask people the same thing, you know, hey, do you think it was, you know, truthful or whatever. But a couple of the comments I got from some of the older people in the audience were, you've got to consider a lot of how, you know, a lot of childbearing at that time, say in the 40s, you know, obviously not to the extent of what it's shown in the movie, but, you know, maybe it was sort of embellished a little bit more by Christina, you know, getting a smack and all those sort of things that were seen as, you know, quite common, I suppose, in the 30s and 40s. So, you know, yeah, that was a common comment I got from older audiences that, yeah, it was also probably kind of reflecting childbearing of that time, obviously not to the extent of wire hangers. But what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, that did cross my mind. Obviously, the old spare the rod, spare the child and other similar barbarities that we've mostly put behind us.
Yeah.
Or at least I hope we have in most places. I mean, that does kind of come into it in some respects. But yeah, obviously the extent that they were showing in this movie would have been far beyond that.
Oh, definitely. Probably the only one I saw that would probably have been quite similar was the part where, not the whole fact that she was trying to beat her in the swimming pool, but the part afterwards when she goes, no, I'm not, and chucks down the towel, and she goes, no, no, listen to me, Missy, and smacks her bum. Like, I can understand that, but then the whole dramatic locking her in the bloody closet and all that sort of stuff. So I could sort of see that little part of that scene as going, yeah, that would have been representative, but obviously not having a mother that essentially beats her daughter at every race in the pool and then gets out and goes, oh, well, you've got to get used to losing, or whatever the line is.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, life's never meant to be fair. You got the feeling Joan Crawford must have had a very, very strict or horrible upbringing, and she took most of it out on Christina. Actually, that's a lot to do with the wire hangers, where a lot of that came from. Apparently, Joan Crawford's mum was a laundress, or, you know, worked at a laundromat, and had a phobia or something to do. It must have stemmed from being a child, because it must have wrecked clothes or something like that. She had an aversion to wire hangers, so that's where that all sort of stemmed from. So, you know, so you think there was obviously a lot of crazy going on in the Crawford family, even at Joan's young age. So, you know, but it seems like she must have had a lot of hardships growing up, and she wanted to give, instead of giving Christina that privileged life that she was supposed to give her, she wanted her to endure exactly what she had.
Yeah, I got that impression through the movie that she wanted to have Christina grow up to be a strong woman like her, and so refused to let her have a lot of the trappings of the privilege that could be afforded to. Like, yeah, she got all these birthday presents, but she could only keep her favourite, and the rest had to be donated to charity. in a which would obviously have been done in a big public spectacle.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and of course, and that, but at the same time too, like it's easy to go, oh God, that was a mean thing to do. That in the public eye, or you know, in some respects, you go, oh, what a lovely thing to do. So you kind of like, yeah, Joan really knew how to manipulate her media. And it sounds like, you know, as you see a lot through the movie, you know, she'd steal a headline wherever she could. And that's why I think, you know, like that shot I mentioned earlier where she's kind of just seen looking at Christina disgustedly. It's like she's, the attention's being taken off me. She's having photos taken. You're like, love, she's a five-year-old child. You know, she was already threatened by her at five. Like, it's like anything she could do to shut her down. And then of course, appearing on that television show, you know, a 60-year-old woman playing a 28-year-old, that was just like, you know, how gutted would Christina have felt about that? It just felt like, you know, oh, so no, you do see in many respects why she wanted to write this book.
I'm not sure how much else we can cover with regards to the movie itself. Are you ready for us to move on to the redeeming feature section?
Yes, I'm interested. I haven't got too many notes as I normally would, but yeah, no, I definitely have some more things to say than I would have about some more of our recent films. But sure, I definitely So, do you want to? Do you want me to kick off with those?
Well, you pick the movie, so I guess I will go first.
Yeah. Okay. No worries. Give me a bit more time to think about it too.
sure thing. Well, first up. Yeah, my first thought at the end of this movie was, what did you make me watch, Christian? I'm guessing that a lot of the division in this movie is how people react to the more distressing scenes, and I've got to say that I reacted very, very, very badly to them. With regards to cruelty to children, I think anyone who has experienced abuse in the past is not going to be able to watch this movie. Like I said before, it almost became the first redeeming features movie that I was not able to watch. It was only sheer willpower pushing me through after the coat hanger scene that got me to the end. The incessant overacting of Faye Dunaway was just plain exhausting. They just went up and stayed up and never went back. The fact that it kept changing the focus of the movie, whether it was about Christina or Joan, it just kept it, I think, from... If it focused one way or the other, I think it could have been a more watchable movie, even taking those scenes aside. But by having to change the focus so much, and it really is at the core of it, the story of Christina getting to the point where she has to write this book and do the tell-all. But most of the focus, most of the rest of the movie is like this Joan Crawford biopic, and they just mention the Christina bits to justify Christina writing the book at the end. The Christopher, the son, one moment he was a kid getting strapped onto a bed for reasons which you've now explained to me, but I've explained in the movie, and then he suddenly turns up at the funeral. And frankly, this movie made me feel so icky. I felt like I had to have a shower afterwards. So, you know, Mummy Dearest has disgusted me almost as much as Swept Away did. This movie was terrible. Reprehensible. There are a couple of lines that you can go, wow, did they really say that? And with the overacting, but you know what, camp only gets you so far. If the movie is terrible, if the movie disgusts you, if the movie gives you more problems than enjoyment, then it's not redeemable.
So we have an irredeemable film from Trevor.
Mm-hmm. Big time.
Whoa. Yeah. It's I definitely, as I mentioned earlier, watching it for the podcast, you know, and taking on a lot more things and getting from feedback I've had from people in the past. Yeah. The scenes of the child abuse really, you know, they just really take a, like what I even said before about John Waters, they take what could have been quite a serious biopic and turned it into something quite campy with those really over-the-top scenes that probably weren't necessary. And perhaps if they'd got someone like Anne Bancroft or not Faye Dunaway to have played the lead role, it may have just come across more of like a television daytime soap and actually might have been quite good. But it's really the fact that Faye really didn't rein her performance in. It was like she was trying to embody, it was like she was trying to make it, yeah, her film. And like what you were saying, it doesn't know whether it wants to be the Christina story or the Joan Crawford story, but it's like Paramount got this product, this Mummy Dearest book, and thought, well, essentially we can make a Joan Crawford movie, you know, really, loosely, and, you know, tie it in with the book. But at the same time, you know, putting down that, you know, this famous Hollywood actress. Interestingly, I read that the only film studio that Joan Crawford never worked for was Paramount, who released this film. So I can understand the others didn't really want to, tread on toes, I suppose, on the recently deceased. But look, Trevor, I'm very mixed. As I said, I've watched it with different eyes again, and definitely those scenes of child abuse like that. I always have to have a break after the wire hanger scene. That's actually where you have the intermission, if you ever have an intermission in the film, and you need it for people to sort of digest it. And you do feel, yeah, exactly, you summed it up. It was quite icky, too over the top. And of course, you know, what could have possibly been just a scene with her going, you've got wire hangers, and probably going a bit insane. In the movie, you've got her repeatedly bashing her, you know, backside and showing close-ups when it's just really not necessary. If you're able to cut out the growth and development of your second adopted child, why do you have to show that stuff in such vivid detail? So, you know, having not read the book, I'm not too sure if that's something that Christina sort of dwells on a lot. I actually, I have seen the film quite a few times, and I think it's kind of got that addictive quality to me for its sort of, yeah, the whole guilty pleasure. And I never like using the term so bad it's good, but it's like, it's like something that you just can't help. You don't want to watch. You can't help but look at it. I don't know. There's something about it, and that's what's always drawn me to it. And I think it's probably just the over the top Faye Dunaway performance. You cannot actually believe this is happening before your eyes. You're essentially watching a career, you know, fail. But at the same time, too, she's almost giving. I've read people say, you know, she's almost giving what should have been nominated for an Academy Award. So, you know, you've got that real mixture there. So I definitely do think the film is redeemable, but more in the fact of being able to show that real, that lavish Hollywood, that sort of, I don't know, the behind the scenes of a film star, not the abuse side, but, you know, the whole getting ready and the many loves and the tragedy and stuff like that. But, yeah, as you said, not knowing whether it wants to be the Christina story or the Joan story. And, yeah, you've got to think, too, most of this book was written from the point of view of a five-year-old. So how much of it is actually true and how much was just sort of filled out and how much more did they add for the movie? I definitely think it's redeemable. You need to see this film just to see this performance by Faye Dunaway, even if it's not an enjoyable experience due to a few scenes. But I definitely think it needs to be on everyone's bucket list just because it's literally, oh, my God. And just some of those scenes, not the abusive ones, but, you know, scenes like the Bring Me the Axe and, you know, this ain't my first time at the rodeo. You know, got those real iconic lines. You know, you see it at least once, see if it lives up to that sort of reputation because, I it does have quite a big reputation. But, yeah, having watched it again in recent times, the child abuse stuff has stood out to me a lot more than it used to in the past. So I think I've become a lot more, yeah, it's not campy. But then, hey, I leave you with the whole point too. Christina turns up to the screenings and gives out wire coat hangers to the audiences as they arrive. So that leaves a weird feeling in my stomach. So it's very hard to know, and I don't think we'll ever know the truth. We've really just got to go on this box office, well, not box office bomb, but this disaster piece from 1981. That's really the legacy that we've been left with Joan Crawford. But yeah, I actually do find it vaguely redeemable.
Right, yeah. So a funny sensation of the stomach and a bad taste in the mouth. I'd probably recommend finding a supercut of just some of focusing on some of just Faye Dunaway's more excessive moments. Rather,
I think there's a few remixes on YouTube where people have remixed a few of her lines over and over again. But yeah, not seeing repetitive slapping of Christina's face doesn't really make for an enjoyable remix. So
yep. So we're divided, but it sounds like not by much.
Look, I think I feel a bit sorry for this film, and it's got that curiosity, that oddball factor, almost that same sort of feeling that I have for sequels, Trevor. You know, that real sort of, I kind of feel sorry for it, but at the same time that you can't help but look at it, but you want to look away. So, yeah, it's yeah, it is vaguely redeemable, and I do recommend people at least see it once in your life just to sort of, to see really what people's thoughts are. Is it an okay movie with a bad performance, or is it just a bad movie? So,
So yeah, if you do see it, see it under the proviso that yes, there are scenes of child abuse in there, and if you have issues with that, you are probably not going to have a good time. However, it does have its fans. We can't deny that. And with regards to the reviews I was digging through, again, there were a lot of essays, and trying to find something that was a bit more succinct was a bit of a challenge, and a bit more of a challenge than with those bad reviews. So I found a bit of a middle ground with this one. The title of this review is Horrible. I Love It. Well, really, what else can be said about Mummy Dearest? Faye Dunaway relentlessly chews up every scene she's in, with those crazy eyes blaring. It's so overwrought and melodramatic that I start laughing as soon as the credits begin. I can't quite think of a role that simultaneously ruined a career and made it star a legend. Faye did that with this movie. Let's not forget that she starred in classic films like Bonnie and Clyde, Chinatown, and won an Oscar for Network. After Mummy Dearest, her star hit bottom, just like Jones did with Metro. Special note should go to the fabulously wooden performance of Diane Scarwood as the older Christina. Diana is a great actress, but she barely had a pulse in this movie, except for the one scene where she told Jones she wasn't one of her fans. That's just one of the memorable moments in this movie. Who can forget No Wire Hangers, Bring Me the Axe, Box Office Poison, When You Clean the Floor, You Have to Move the Plant, I'm Not Mad at You, I'm Mad at the Dirt, and of course, Don't With Me, Fellas. It makes me all warm and fuzzy just thinking about it. 5 stars.
So that person obviously understands the camp value of it too, but yeah, when you're saying horrible but I love it, yeah, that kind of sums up, I think, what fans even think of it too. I think it's just one of these things they just, I don't know, I just can't believe it. I don't know how I'd feel going to a midnight screening in America where they're all throwing wire hangers, especially in that scene, because it to me just seems to be totally jarring. So I think that would be quite an odd experience.
Indeed, indeed. I think a more balanced movie, even with it over the performance, may well have helped bring it up a bit, but yeah, camp only goes so far.
Yeah, exactly. And hey, I suppose if it's essentially a tell-all book, it's going to be trashy to start with anyway. So it's probably perfect that it was a trashy movie. So, but yeah, so it does have people very divided, as it has with us. So, but only just.
Indeed, indeed. And I think we should move on, because the sooner we wrap this up, the sooner I can go have that shower and get the icky feeling off me.
Especially all the Ajax.
Yeah. And you know what? I thought for the next movie, it's time to move away from the horror movies. I do consider this a horror movie.
Yeah.
Just like I also considered Speed 2 a horror movie, and then Dracula 3000 and Blood Rain, The Third Reich. Well, basically, they were horror movies. So
yeah.
I'm going to a movie that comes from a much different source that some people may consider horror, but still is quite a, I think it's an area that we haven't really dived much into on the redeeming features. Ooh. And that's the area of classic cartoons turned into live action movies. I know we did do Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 3, but beyond that, I don't think we've done much in this area.
Ooh, I'm interested. I love this.
Mm-hmm. And there's quite a wide range to choose from. So I thought another break from tradition, I'd go with something really, really recent. So recent that it's only really us with that magical internet access to get stuff that's available for viewing online overseas can actually see, because I believe it's actually in Australian cinemas as we record this. Because Australia is a few months behind. So yes, we're watching a movie from 2015. A movie based on an 80s cartoon, yet this movie adaptation has been lambasted for having virtually nothing to do with said 80s cartoon.
Ooh, Christian, I know
we're going to watch Gem and the Holograms.
I knew it. Oh, my gosh. I have heard nothing but terrible, terrible things about this, and I can't wait to see it. Having never actually heard of the original TV series until mention of the movie, like I'd never heard of it, and then people showing me clips of the original series and then telling me, oh my god, this movie's terrible. Apparently it's had the worst opening of a movie ever. It made like $10,000 or something ridiculous. So Trevor, I am interested to see it.
Well, the original cartoon series was truly outrageous, and this movie, however, just seems to cause outrage. So, yeah, I haven't seen it myself. I've only seen the trailer myself, so it's going to be a voyage of discovery.
Ooh, have you seen the original, you've seen the original cartoon?
I have. I actually have watched a number of episodes of the original cartoon, and I do think that we probably need to watch a few episodes to sort of get that baseline before we watch this movie.
Yeah, apparently they are available on YouTube, so I think I might initiate myself with that, just so I've got something to compare it with. But I'm up for the challenge, Trev, because I'm more intrigued than anything else.
Fantastic. And yeah, I need something light. I really need something light.
Especially after Mummy Dear. Yeah, it is essentially a horror film.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about all you out there listeners listening to this? Do you think we were too harsh on Mummy Dearest? Do you think we were too generous? We would love to know. We'd also like to know if you have seen Gem and the Holograms, what are your thoughts? You can easily get in touch with us to let us know. You can send us an email to therufusproject@gmail.com. You can head to our homepage, rufusproject.com, and leave a comment below this very episode. You can also leave comments through iTunes, and if you do, why not give us a rating and review as well, because that would be really cool if you did. So yeah, very easy to get in touch with us, and we would love to hear your thoughts and even your suggestions.
Always open to them, because yeah, we've managed to dig them up from far and wide. So yeah, I'm up for the challenge of a comedy next time, Trevor. So yeah, let's lighten it up a bit. But never know, it could end up a horror movie as well.
I've got a suspicion of the horror movie line I did before may come back and kick me in the butt.
But hey, if we are doing a redeeming features cast, it's probably perfect that they're all horrors, if you know what I mean. Horrific to watch, so I'm up for the challenge. I'm actually interested to see it, so looking forward to chatting about it.
Fantastic. Well, Christian, as always, I can't say it was a pleasure watching this movie, but it's always great chatting with you about them.
Thank you very much, and thanks for letting me make you watch this. It's always good to initiate another person with the film and get their opinion of it. And I'm up for the challenge of Gem and the Hologram. So look forward to chatting to you then.
Fantastic. See you then.
See ya.
Too good to be bad, so bad it's good. What's this movie? Do you think we should? It's got bad dialogue, dodgy creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Boy? Oh boy.
Christian and Trevor on the case, watching movies from all over the place. IMDb says it's bad, but we want to know, is it fun to be had?
Boy? Oh boy.
Redeeming features.